industrial accidents,
ancient
solving
poisoners,
crime,
poison
chemical
prevention.
Spills. This is Toxic History.
Dr. Jason Dietz obtained his medical degree from Ireland, and with a background in internal medicine, he practiced as a hospitalist for 3 years before returning to study toxicology in New York City.
Today, I'm delighted to be here. Because toxicologists are cultured and classy people, we're going to talk about art and the color green. So let's just start with a beautiful picture. Green is the color of nature and life and growth, and chlorophyll might be the most abundant pigment out there. And if you check back in your diary, you might recall that greenery was Pantone's color of the year in 2017. So things that are green feel like they should be associated with nature and the environment. They seem like they should also, by extension, be safe and natural and good. And the reality is that for thousands of years, there was not a good green pigment. Artists were dependent on grinding up minerals, some examples of which are pictured here. And the colors were normally earthy or dull. And many natural pigments are plagued by fading or slow oxidation to kind of a brown-black color when they're exposed to air or water, or even when they're mixed with the wrong nearby pigments. And so people who write about art, at least nowadays, often overlook the very practical side of the craft of art. Any work of art is determined first and foremost by the materials available to the artist. So this required proximity to either mines for some of these things, or a port city with good trade, or depending on how rare and unusual the metal or the compound was, a lot of money. So outcome was dependent on the artist's ability to manipulate these materials, and how finely the minerals were ground prior to immersion with oil could have a significant impact on the color. And you see that with the malachite there, fine, medium, and coarse, it really does look very different. The color green was so challenging that sometimes it was not green at all. If you look back through some of the Renaissance art, what they actually did is they carefully layered paints over one another to kind of try to create that impression. All right, now the fun part. Let's mispronounce some names together. Enter Carl Wilhelm Scheele. And, oh, he was a strapping visionary of a man, if we only acknowledge this one picture. He was a Swedish chemist, and he discovered the aptly named Scheele's green, or Swedish green, based on his country of origin. In 1775, he was doing research on arsenic, and he presented this discovery to the Royal Academy of Sciences in Stockholm in a publication. He was willing to share his work in 1778, which is seen at the right there. So synthesis of this pigment involved mixing solutions of copper sulfate and arsenic trioxide. We're already off to a good start, which was dissolved with the aid of potassium carbonate, and then you precipitate out the pigment you want, which is copper arsenite. But Carl wasn't an unfeeling man, and he wondered if we should not do a better job of warning the public about the dangers of arsenic. After all, he studied this. But ultimately, it was felt that as a paint alone, or just placed on a wall, it posed little risk to the consumer. Not to be outdone, even more innovations were occurring in Germany. So in 1808, Wilhelm Sattler began a paint manufacturing business in Schweinfurt, Germany. And he performed experiments, and he was trying to improve on this, and he made an even more vivid green that retained its brilliance over time. This naturally was marketed as either Schweinfurt green or some other names, but this time the composition was a secret. It was a trade secret. So the new pigment was widely available throughout Europe and North America, and pretty steadily started to replace the inferior Scheele's green, partly because of its ability to age and be even more vibrant. So now we get to the names, right? This extraordinary confusion of nomenclature. This list comes from a real authority, not from me, from the National Gallery of Art in Washington, which publishes extensively on the topic of historical pigments. And the confusion comes up over and over again. Some of the listed names are derived from the site where they were manufactured. That's understandable. We see that already. Some were originally thought to be different compounds, but because of these trade secrets, sometimes the buyer or even the manufacturer might not know they were making the same product. And some of the rebranding was probably an intentional attempt to conceal the toxic nature of the paint. Once one name and brand was tainted, you just moved on to a different name, which we still do today. And this was a major moment for the industrialization of art. So we see science, or we see art and science, as two kind of opposite ends of a spectrum, but they're closely intertwined. And new pigments were now the byproduct of an industrial chemical process. So arsenopyrite, which had contaminated the flumes of copper, tin, lead, smelting furnaces, now had this economic value. And indeed, many of the world's major chemical companies BASF, SIBA, even Bayer back in the day, began as manufacturers of synthetic dyes, even if not specifically green. And enter the Impressionists and their descendants, so Van Gogh, Matisse, Gauguin, Kandinsky, who embraced these new colors and the world that chemistry was offering up to them. And we see the examples that we've already talked about as kind of a large part of their new palette. And so colors could now enhance or distort the world around you. You see this, some of these images have amazing quantities of green. It takes time to load because they're so high resolution and beautiful. We have Van Gogh in his self-portrait. The whole base there, when they really look at it, is Paris green. And then this image shows that although we talk about these pigments as though they're a static entity, you can walk into a museum and you can see that pigment. Obviously, artists are continually mixing them. So the incredible value of some of these works, the monetary value, has helped to propel the research with electron microscopy or X-ray diffraction or other resource-intensive investigations that continue to bring new scientific understanding. And it certainly was just not the art world. So book covers, ornamental flowers, countless fabrics all had the same arsenical green pigments, as were soaps and children's toys and candles and everything. The candy at the top right is not green because, unfortunately, prior to TikTok, there just aren't as many pictures of food. But there were clearly documented cases of confectionery centerpieces at fine dining, which had sugar green leaves and flowers, and the partygoers would take these home to their children, and then their children would die. And there are some reasonably well-reported cases of that. And there, lurking in the background in all these rooms as we focus on everything else, was also an incredible amount of arsenic on the walls. So the 19th century was a very exciting time, both in the technical and the style development of wallpaper. There was also a transition from this carved block printing and the hand finishing, really labor-intensive work of individual sheets to the far more efficient roller processes seen here. And London was, for a long time, the center of the industry. British production increased to 32 million rolls back in 1874. But mechanization also meant that adult-skilled workers, needed in part for their strength, could now be replaced by children with significant financial savings. So who was getting exposed in these factories? William Morris, the name listed down at the bottom here, was really the kingpin of the wallpaper world. He was a supporter of the arts and crafts movement and an advocate for traditional pigments, traditional dyes. And these really are some of the examples of wallpaper from that era. Not surprisingly, he also had shares in the Devonshire Great Consolidated Mining Company, which was a copper mine on the decline, but poised to make great returns on the sale of arsenic, what was previously always thought of as a byproduct. And these wallpapers became the backdrop for daily life throughout Europe. But arsenic remained an element in kind of two worlds. It was a common tonic for health. People were still using it in Fowler's solution and all these other things that we've talked about in other venues, but it was a known poison. And so this cartoon really highlights that this wasn't lost on people. This is my appearance after a good dose of arsenic taken medicinally, with the death lurking around the corner. And in fact, some of the same catalogs that marketed Paris green as a pigment for the artist offered the identical product as an insecticide, which it was fairly effective at. So there's even reports that it was used to kill rats in Parisian sewers, which is at least mythically part of the reason why it's claimed to have the name Paris Green sometimes. But it wasn't all bad. So tenants often delighted in the association between wallpaper and a reduced incidence of bed bugs. So silver linings all around. But nothing good lasts forever. So Bavaria banned the manufacture or sale of arsenical wallpapers in 1845. They were pretty quick on the draw. However, it remained unregulated in the US, the Netherlands, Greece, Italy, Belgium, so many other European countries for decades to come. And whether ultimately goaded by scientists or the public, or maybe even their own conscience, they did come to embrace the virtues of arsenic-free paper. You can see the highlighting there from their advertisement that this is free from arsenic. Okay, so we know about wallpaper of the era. Now we get to our dear, humble, lowly protagonist. Napoleon Bonaparte, and his most unrelenting of enemies, wallpaper. So, home, here's where it all started off. And when he proved after his first exile that he still had a penchant for starting wars, the ship sailed a little further afield to the island of St. Helena in the Atlantic Ocean. And that is our backdrop. So, on that island is Longwood House, This would be Napoleon's less than palatial final residence and the place where he would ultimately die on May 5th, 1821. So again, we're going a little farther back, kind of very much in that era of the wallpaper. He was 51 years old. And as with any good historical figure, there's plenty of competing hypotheses, or we can call them conspiracy theories, whatever your flavor, regarding his death. And he certainly did nothing to help this. To anyone who would listen, and also in his last will and testament, he wrote, "I died before my time, murdered by the English oligarchy and its hired assassin," which is, I mean, just great. I so look forward to putting that in my own will. But one of the enduring theories, spread even faster by the internet, is that he died from arsenic poisoning from this wallpaper. And so we need some data. How, you ask, could we possibly know what wallpaper was in that room in 1821? Well, the answer may or may not surprise you if you're from New York City. It relies on the fact that tourists are incredibly destructive human beings. And sure enough, a visitor to the site, very soon after his death, tore a piece of wallpaper from the wall and pasted it into a scrapbook, which they brought back to the UK. And that happened in either May or June of 1825. And so years later, kind of just by circumstance, there was a radio interview talking about Napoleon and the possible causes of his death, and possibly wallpaper would be helpful. And the family that had the scrapbook realized that the artifact might be of scientific interest, and they brought it to the attention of the researchers. Pictures of the room from Napoleon's time were able to confirm that the swatch had the correct pattern. So we really have the actual wallpaper. It also showed that the wallpaper was installed in 1819, so it couldn't have contributed to his arsenic, at least not that particular wallpaper, before that date. The wallpaper was known to contain Sheila's green, which ironically Napoleon himself probably selected, and direct testing of the sample, which was published in a number of scientific papers now, averaged 120 milligrams of arsenic per square meter. And then if you look kind of at the rosette within that picture, up to 1500 milligrams per square meter in those specific areas. So to support this cause of death, countless research papers have pored over the heavy metal results of Napoleon's hair. We see this in toxicology time and again. And an astounding number of individuals, many with quite plausible stories of how they came to get it, came forward to share their hidden treasures in the form of his hair samples. Seems like everyone had a piece of Napoleon's hair. And as we learned in other tox history presentations right here, call back, excellent. The presence of arsenic on the hair is far from a conclusory finding, and there are many other ways, some of them even medical, that Napoleon could have received arsenic. So the only tie-in we really have is we have these objective arsenic findings, at least on the hair. But if you believe the theory, the hard part is connecting the dots between all the arsenic on the wall and the human poisoning. Was it just falling off the wall and people were eating it? And there have been cases of that. It wasn't until 1893, still quite a long time ago, that a more plausible mechanism was directly investigated. So on damp wallpaper, which people were often layering one right over the other, and it was retaining moisture, and they were using flour-based paste, all these molds were growing, some of them that you couldn't even see behind the paper. And these molds can then metabolize arsenic compounds into the more volatile form, arsenic trimethyl, the toxicity of which probably has been a little bit overstated, but it is at least a plausible mechanism. And ultimately, we have these great theories, but this is a man who got an autopsy, whether you choose to believe it or not, and the final cause of his death can never be certain, but there were more than eight physicians in attendance and many independent accounts of their findings. So one of the more respected reports lists carcinoma of the stomach complicated by gastric bleeding, which may or may not have been precipitated by a large dose of calomel, which is its own tox concern, but it does seem that a GI issue was the primary cause of death. So that brings us to the modern era. Although there are far more formulations of green, it is still challenging. Green-colored plastic and paper is often more difficult to recycle. Pigment green 7, also known as phthalocyanine green, while now one of the most common green pigments in some applications, is an organic pigment that contains an abundance of chlorine and some forms of which can cause cancer and birth defects. Other popular pigments, pigment green 36, pigment green 50, either contain bromine or everything from cobalt to titanium to nickel to zinc oxide. So for the connoisseurs, the truly obnoxious connoisseurs, you can't talk about paint without talking about Farrow and Ball. Oh, and nobody who ever had to paint a room said that when it cost more than $150 a gallon. But to their credit, the company started when trying to make historical colors for restoration. So they actually were part of the National Trust properties in the UK, and they were acutely aware of all the history behind this. And they, of course, came out with arsenic color. I like this just because it sums up everything about the world of art and fashion by saying we know what kills you, but what a lively, stimulating feel. So where does that leave us? Contrary to what Plato and Carrillo would have you believe, we haven't given up on the idea that art should sometimes kill you. But when we think about occupations and risks, at least now for our jobs going forward, art probably doesn't rise to the top of that list. This is just one text now in multiple editions. There's many others that focus on not just the artists being aware of kind of their own risks, but also for the toxicologist, being aware of what are other people doing, especially for someone like myself with very little of an art background. And so hopefully that gives you some framework for green, but I don't want you to feel too down. Just when you really want to give up on green, you see this wonderful, seductive picture of Kermit the Frog. You look into those eyes and you think, maybe it's all going to be okay.